Welcome back to the program. In 1835, Alexis de Tocqueville found a unique set of American character traits, traits that in total would come to define the American experience. Today, most of those traits are still with us, but we often lose sight of them. Sometimes it takes an outsider to remind us of those things that make us, if not exceptional, at least unique in what we've been able to achieve as a nation. My guest this morning, Daniel Hannan, is a conservative member of the European Parliament and first came to international prominence when he took on then-British Prime Minister Gordon Brown regarding his economic policies. In his recently published book, The Road to Serfdom, Hannan sounds a clarion call to America not to be seduced by all that seems attractive about the European system. Since the publication of the book, he has proved prescient in several ways. It is my pleasure to welcome Daniel Hannan here to talk about his book, The New Road to Serfdom, A Letter of Warning to America. Daniel Hannan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
Delight to have you here. What's wrong with this country becoming more like Europe?
Well, you've preserved the best bits of what we used to do, the freedom, the democracy, the independence, and we've kind of surrendered it all with the European Union. I mean, let me put it like this, since you're a program that's based in Napa. When the grapes first came from Europe to California, they came from European stocks, you know, from French and Italian vines. Then in the 19th century, there was a blight called phylloxera that wiped out all of the vineyards in Europe. And in order to restock the European vineyards, people had to come back to California and take cuttings and find the same varieties and repopulate where the ancestral vines had been wiped out. Now, I kind of think that we need to do something similar with our democracy. I mean, we've gone down this road towards uniformity and centralization, high tax, high regulation, and with the disastrous consequences that you now see on your TV screens from what's going on in Europe. The terrifying thing for me is when I watch what's happening in the U.S. and I see you kind of on the same road. I mean, thankfully not as far advanced as Europe is, but imagine what it would have been like for those European viticulturists when they got to California if they'd found the aphids already on the leaf and they'd seen that it was all being withered there as well. That's what depresses me when I see the U.S. going down this road towards bigger government.
When one looks at the European experience, though, it is something that happened over a protracted period of time. It was not one event or one single thing necessarily, but a series of decisions, a series of events that led down that road.
Yes, and the one great advantage that you guys have is that all of those events, those series of mistakes, go back to the same foundational error. Line 1 of Article 1 of the Foundational Treaty of the EU commits its signatories to ever closer union. And basically, as government has got more centralized in Europe, it's got more remote, it's got further from the people, it's therefore got bigger and more wasteful and less efficient. You are very lucky in that the US was founded in a popular revolt against a distant and remote government. And therefore, the sympathy of the founders was with the maximum dispersal of powers. And almost to this day, the things that make U.S. democracy unusual, the markers that distinguish you from other countries, the open primaries, the states' rights, the devolution of power, the direct election of everybody from the sheriff to the school board, the recall mechanisms, the ballot procedures, all of those things are developments of this basic kind of Jeffersonian ideal that decisions should be taken as closely as possible to the people that they affect. And that's, you know, the system has worked. You know, your constitution has done its job. It did exactly what the framers intended. It's kept the government constrained, and it's made the country prosperous and successful and free. But, you know, once you throw that away, once you decide to become just like the rest of the world, you won't be able to get it back again. Government is much better at grabbing new powers than it is at returning them.
What about the idea, though, that we are moving away from those things globally, that the world is becoming more interconnected in every way, that globalization makes those things happening on a local level less and less efficient?
Well, it's funny. The kind of globalization that that we shouldn't have a problem with is the kind that involves free exchange of goods and free exchange of ideas that drives growth, and it, in the past 50 years, has brought humanity to a peak of wealth and success and longevity and literacy that we have never known before. It doesn't have to go hand in hand with a globalization of politics and a globalization of government and a development of international jurisdiction. I mean, one of the funny things is when you look at all these Occupy crowds, the kind of globalization that they should be most worried about, the really sinister kind that takes power away from democracies and concentrates it in the hands of remote elites, is this globalization by the UNs, by the big global NGOs and so on. And for some reason, that doesn't seem to bother them. You can get the good bits, you know, the organic coming together of people, the fact that I can buy and sell over the internet with the other side of the world, without needing to hand away your sovereignty and your democracy to people that you can't vote for.
There is the sense, though, that these things have gone or are going hand in hand in so many respects. I mean, in many ways, it results in less dynamic economic growth, and it confuses people in terms of the difference between, as you talk about, pro-business versus pro-market.
Well, it's a distinction that is often lost on my lefty friends. I mean, one of the things that astonished me was I went to speak to some of the Occupy people in the UK outside St. Paul's Cathedral. I mean, our Occupy crowd are such numbskulls that they couldn't occupy the stock exchange, so they occupied a nearby church on grounds that it was kind of vaguely near the stock exchange. You know, they weren't all bad people. A lot of them were touchingly idealistic, but the thing that really struck me was how wide of the mark were the views that they attributed to conservatives. And one of the things, I mean, a lot of them recognized me from TV, and a lot of them thought that because I was an evil capitalist, I must have been in favor of the bank bailouts. And, you know, how far from reality do you have to be? I mean, the one lot of people who were against these wretched bailouts were the free marketeers. We don't like bailouts. We don't like nationalization. We don't like subsidies. Of course we were against the bailouts. But, there's this sense that if you're on the side of the rich, you know, if you're free markets, you're on the side of the rich, and therefore you want to support them, whatever. You know, sometimes the pro-market and the pro-business case happens to coincide, but sometimes it doesn't. And in the instance of these bailouts, they plainly didn't. The interest of the big banks was inimical to the interest of the economy as a whole. And the countries which decreed the biggest bailouts, tragically yours and mine, are the ones which suffered the worst downturns.
It is also ironic in some respects that while pro-market has been successful as an intellectual idea internationally, it has not transferred entirely to the realm of public policy.
You put it absolutely beautifully. Yeah, we've won the battle of ideas. We've lost the battle of implementation. I mean, if you look at how a debate was conducted on the radio 50 years ago, the assumptions that people had about the role of the state were way, way to the left of where they are now. People thought it was quite proper that the state should be the, you know, main actor in the field of housing, of healthcare, and so on. Very few people make those arguments now. The number who really believe in planning is much diminished. But at the same time, over those 50 years, the share of GDP taken by the state has steadily grown in every Western country. Powers have grown, you know, for every government bureaucracy. And here's the tragedy. You know, the free market guy gets elected, gets to be a minister. But the moment he takes office, he finds that he's encased in this massive bureaucratic machine. And whatever he thought he was going to do when he was standing for election, he just can't do it. He's pulling at the levers, but they've worked loose. He's jabbing furiously at the buttons, but they've been disconnected because there is this enormous state bureaucracy now composed of people who have a personal vested interest in higher government spending.
How should we view the Scandinavian countries, which in many ways have adopted many of these ideas that you write about in The New Road to Serfdom, and yet have managed to do it within the context of a dynamic economy?
Well, yes, that was a question that used to really puzzle me, and to the extent that I bothered to go and visit some of these countries and talk to people and study how it had worked. And there are two things which are interesting. First of all, we lump them all together as Scandinavia. I mean, of course, they differ one from another. Denmark always had fiercely kind of free market employment laws. And so although it had a very high tax take, it was very easy to fire people, which meant that it was very easy to hire them when the times were good. But I would say the main thing is this. We're talking about small countries. You know, Denmark, population of 5 million. Norway, population of 4 million. Iceland, population of 300,000. You know, a small, homogenous society where the difference between left and right is small, where the difference between rich and poor is small, where all the political parties would fit in one of your or one of our political parties. In a society like that, weirdly, you can sustain a bigger role for the state because there are fewer unintended consequences, because people are all kind of similar in their outlook and their behavior. They all went to the same kind of school. They all have the same kind of values, which is why, by the way, immigration has had such a huge impact on those countries, more than in other places, because even though the numbers are not as huge as in some parts of Europe, the impact on the fabric of society, which had been so dependent on this similarity of outlook, has been enormous. I think that allowed them to get away with things. Having said that, I mean, they have drawn back substantially, and Norway in particular has now got a really very successful kind of free market model, largely because it's outside the European Union and is therefore able to pursue a much more deregulated model than it would if it was subject to Brussels regulations.
So what is it then about pluralism within a society that impacts on these issues regarding free markets and bureaucracies?
Well, I would say that the more distant the government gets from the people, the more it has to depend on rules that don't always fit the situation, you know. So, I mean, a good example of this is the very successful welfare reforms that happened under the, you know, the Gingrich, or if you like, the Clinton Act. There was devolution first from Washington to the states, and then in many cases, like in Florida, from the states to the counties. And the result of this is that there was experimentation, there was trialing of new ideas, there was, you know, people copying what worked elsewhere, mimicking best practice, and that really worked. And by the way, one of the unnoticed tragedies of the recent regulation is the extent to which the federal government has now reassumed control over welfare. I would say that's just a really good thing, and it applies in education, applies in healthcare, applies in the economy. The more you disperse power, the more you encourage variety, diversity, pluralism, allow people to compete with each other, not only do you get happier and more democratic societies, you get more prosperous and more dynamic societies.
So are the problems then less political and more structural?
Yeah. I would say that when people talk about culture, they are usually just not looking closely enough at the incentives. You know, very often, I mean, I'm a huge admirer of the traditional American model, enormous fan of the extraordinary constitution that your founders put together. You know, I get really quite misty-eyed about it when I go to the old courthouse in Philadelphia. But I talk to American friends about this, and they say, yeah, well, it's a cultural thing. You know, we don't have the hang-ups that you have in the old world with your monarchies and your class systems and so on. That's kind of missing the point. You know, culture is not some kind of disembodied entity that exists next to the institutions. Culture is a product of the institutions. And the reason that there is a basically dynamic society in the U.S. is because it's structured that way. Now, you know, this, by the way, was something that your founders absolutely understood. Jefferson used to say, we could export this model anywhere. If anybody copied our Republican system of government, they would also gain the benefits of it. The reverse of that is true. Once you guys go down the road towards having European levels of tax, European levels of debt, European levels of government regulation, you see how quickly you will get a dependent, welfareized, infantilized population resisting any kind of economic reform, because people respond to incentives. You know, there's no magical quality in the American soil or the American sky or the American gene pool. What has served to make your country rich and successful and free is its institutions. And if you give those institutions up, you're going to miss them.
I want to come back to this idea of immigration, also combined with what you were saying about the Scandinavian model, in that in many ways, many of the European countries started out as much more homogeneous populations, with the idea that the more socialist system could work within the context of that population, and pluralism and immigration and has changed all that and made it more like America, which was pluralistic, arguably, from the very beginning.
I think that's right. I mean, the more you get different kinds of people with different levels of education, different income, and so on, the more you get unintended consequences, and the harder it is to apply a single legal framework to everybody. You also get other strains on society. You get, in a society where everybody knows their neighbors, you are almost certain to have kind of lower crime, lower antisocial behavior, lower graffiti. I mean, why would you drop litter when you're just wrecking the quality of life of your immediate friends and relatives? Whereas in a big city with a transient population where nobody really knows each other, you know, we have social problems attendant on that. Now, that needn't be the consequence of immigration. If immigration is properly handled, you can very quickly build a sense of common identity. The US was very, very good at that, has historically been enormously good at that, because in a sense the country was designed partly for that purpose. In the words of that great Californian, and in a characteristically upbeat and optimistic phrase, Ronald Reagan said, "Every immigrant makes America more American," you know, which is it's a wonderful thing to hear, right? It's a lovely, positive, kind of sunshiny phrase. Now, the reason why you've been good at it is because you've given people something to believe in. It's very easy to buy into the patriotism and the pride and the sense of belonging of a country that still has self-belief. And the difficulty that a lot of European countries have is that when patriotism has been systematically derided and traduced by the ruling elites for the last 30 or 40 years, when everyone is taught as official doctrine that the nation state is finished and we all have to be Europeans now, when they've even surrendered their passports and adopted this kind of pan-European one, it's much harder for the newcomer to want to belong, because what is there for him to belong to if all the message he gets from the state, from the education system and so on, is that, you know, patriotism is a discredited 19th century dangerous concept? And I think, again, there is a lesson for you. I mean, if you guys go around apologizing to everyone and hanging your heads and, as your president does, saying that America's been too arrogant and so on, not only does that not make you any more popular abroad, but it makes it that much harder for the newcomer to want to settle in.
But certainly national, extreme nationalism and extreme exceptionalism have caused their level of angst in the world historically as well.
Well, I don't know about extreme exceptionalism. I'm hugely in favor. You know, the most exceptional country governmentally in Europe is probably Switzerland, which has stayed out of the EU, is completely surrounded by the EU, has a much more American-type government in the sense that it has referendums and devolved power and so on. And I don't think anyone quakes in their boots at the fear of a Swiss army tramping across their territory. Extreme nationalism in the sense of kind of blood and soil bellicosity, of course, that is a negative force, but the biggest antidote to it is democracy. You know, you generally don't get bourgeois democracies making war against each other. Countries that are trading and have an interest in selling to each other's customers are not countries that like to fight each other.
Is there a middle ground in all of this as the United States moves towards some aspects of what it perceives as the good parts of a European model, and as Europe, coming through its current crisis, looks to the United States, as you talked about at the outset? Is there a middle ground that works within this globalized international framework of the world today?
Well, I think the ground that works is actually not in between where you are and where we are. It's kind of somewhere on the other side. I mean, both of us have this huge problem that we have been, and when I say both of us, I mean the entire Western world, we've got a problem that for the last couple of decades, we have been increasing our consumption without any commensurate increases in our production. We've been stimulating demand, but we haven't been stimulating productivity. And we've been bridging the difference with debt. We've been borrowing more and more in order to sustain our standard of living. And there is no law that entitles us to this living standard in the world today. There is no reason why there is a boy getting up and working a 16-hour day in Bangalore so that we can sit back and play on our Game Boys. We have to earn our living in the world. And both of us face the same problem, which is that we've been living beyond our means. And both of us have been making the same mistakes since the credit crunch hit. We've been treating the debt crisis with more debt. We've been adopting further loans when we can't meet our existing liabilities. We've been expanding the government still further. So I think the ideal, both for us and for you, is somewhere closer to what the constitutional model that your founders originally envisaged was, where government is more dispersed and smaller, where the citizen is more autonomous, and where people are trusted to be responsible. If you give people responsibility, they behave responsibly.
That means, though, that Europeans have a lot further to go in that direction. Is that possible?
That's a very good question. There will come a point when you have such a large chunk of the electorate that is one way or another dependent on the state, either through the welfare and social security system or more usually as an employee within the public sector, that it becomes very difficult for a government to win an election or for a party to win an election on a promise of lower spending. And, you know, what we're seeing in Greece, for example, is an almost total societal resistance to any notion of fiscal retrenchment because there are so many people who stand to lose from it. But I think you can always make that argument. You know, this was an argument that people used to make to Margaret Thatcher when she was the opposition leader in the 70s. It was made then not about the state sector, but about trade union membership. You know, you can't possibly win without doing a deal with the trade unions. There are, when you include all the wives and dependents, you've almost got a majority in the electorate. You're going to have to make a deal with them. And her reply was to say, people will not think and vote only as trade unionists. I can also appeal to them as parents or as consumers or as patriots. You know, I'm going to make people raise their eyes beyond what they happen to do for a living. And that worked. And she did it because she had a way of projecting a positive vision. In a similar way to Reagan, he had a very good way of carrying people with him towards what was going to be a better tomorrow. And I think that's really the challenge for people who believe in limited government today. We have to phrase the argument not in terms of just being against things, but in favor of being for things, being for freedom and for prosperity and for sustainable growth.
Daniel Hannan, his book is The New Road to Serfdom, A Letter of Warning to America. Daniel, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My great pleasure, Jeff.
Thank you.